Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 920. The Trump and Confabanda, part 3. The Underground Reich comes into plain view. This is being recorded on September 1st of the year 2016. We are going to continue with our analysis of the Donald Trump candidacy and the political legacy and ideology and financial and political allegiances of Donald Trump. The title, the Trump and Confabanda, is, or the term Trump and Confabanda, is something that I made up. Obviously, it is derived from Donald Trump's name. Confabanda is a designation for German World War II infantry units. And that basically, I think, is altogether appropriate for Donald Trump. In this program, we are going to be analyzing the Trump phenomenon. We're going to be taking a look at the political heritage being manifested by Donald Trump, something that goes all the way back to the Nazi Fifth Column in this country and the German-American component in that in particular. I would note in that regard that Donald Trump's family are of German heritage, and his father, Fred Trump, who was very influential in shaping Donald Trump's career, may very well have been in the Ku Klux Klan. Certainly his father, at a relatively young age, was one of a number of people arrested in a 1927 Ku Klux Klan demonstration in New York City. He was not charged, and the circumstances are somewhat ambiguous at this point in time. Trump has denied that that was his father. That obviously is, as is the case with Donald Trump, less than candid. And he also has claimed that the incident did not take place at all, which it most assuredly did. When we look at Donald Trump as a political animal, when we look at the heritage that he is manifesting, and when we take a look at the political forces with which he is allied and whose political water he is carrying and whose political agenda he is manifesting, I think it is impossible, frankly, not to see the historical links going back to fascism and Nazism of the World War II period. And beyond that, to take a look at Trump is to take a look at the evolution of a fascist milieu through the Cold War period and right on up through the post-Cold War period, when Trump has become more or less openly affiliated with what is now being journalistically termed the alt-right. I don't like the term. It's basically a fascist milieu, although I doubt that many of the people, certainly a lot of the people involved with it, would not, at a superficial level, embrace corporatist economics. And yet, as was the case with many people attracted to Nazism at the street level in the World War II and pre-World War II periods, many of them were simply ignorant, and they thought the world was run by a Jewish conspiracy, and that if we just got rid of the Jews, that would basically free them from the shackles of finance capital. That was, in fact, not the case. And by embracing Nazism, they were, in fact, welding those shackles around their feet with a very, very firm solder indeed. We are also in this program at the end going to take a look at the dominant financial backer of Donald Trump in For the Record 919, the second program in our analysis of the Trump and Confabanda. We took a look at a New York Times story that investigated the highly opaque Donald Trump real estate holdings. And one of the things they were able to determine was that Bormann Capital Network banks like Deutsche Bank and the Union Bank of Switzerland were major players in some of Trump's financial dealings. And beyond that, a number of highly complex companies that yielded an altogether opaque picture of Trump's operations appear to have been either fronts for or perhaps money laundering vehicles for prominent Germans, German aristocrats, and German industrial families. In this program, we are going to take a look at the single dominant financial institution that has backed Donald Trump. That is Deutsche Bank, the largest commercial bank in Germany and an institution that is inextricably linked with fascism and Nazism. It was the most important Nazi bank in the pre-World War II and World War II period and a dominant element in German finance in the post-World War II period. The Deutsche Bank is deeply involved with the Bormann Capital Network, and Deutsche Bank has been the single dominant institution in financing Trump's various real estate projects. Beyond that, we're going to take a look at how George Soros apparently helped Donald Trump to maneuver out of the dire straits of a mezzanine loan. That is an extraordinarily high interest rate type of loan that he took out in connection with some of his high-rise projects in Chicago. George Soros, as we have seen in the past, got his start in business Aryanizing Jewish property in Hungary during the Holocaust, something he does not feel any real guilt about. And in his autobiography, he described that period of time as the happiest in his life. We have suggested, and I don't think, frankly, it is much of a reach, that the nominally Jewish George Soros is, in fact, what I have termed a Bormann Jew. In his seminal work, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, Paul Manning has noted that one of the MOs of the Bormann Capital Network is to use Jews as frontmen. This not only hides the Nazi nature of those operations. What, for example, could be a better vehicle for masking Nazi financial maneuvering than using a Jewish front man or woman or institution? Beyond that, because many of those individuals and institutions maintained a high level of contribution to Israel, it also kept the international Zionist community quiet as well. We look at this in For the Record program number 305, among others. In For the Record 918 and 919, both of which dealt with German Ostpolitik, I noted that Trump's pronouncements on NATO and Putin and Ukraine and Russia, although they have been spun as indicating that he is pro-Russian or perhaps even a Kremlin ally or dupe, actually makes far more sense if we look at the history of German Ostpolitik. And For the Record 918, I noted the open letter to Stalin that was published in 1949 in the Burger Zeitung, a very important German language paper in the U.S., and a journalistic outlet for the political ideology and pronouncements of the Steuben Society. That is a prominent German-American institution or society that was part of the pre-World War II Nazi Fifth Column in the U.S. and part of the post-World War II underground Reich Nazi Fifth Column in the U.S. Their open letter to Stalin proposed that Germany would move away from the West and establish an alliance with Russia, provided they were able to basically reinstall Nazis in power. And this third power bloc would A, achieve a unified Europe, B, would create a German-dominated all-European army, and C, ultimately leave NATO and move away from the U.S. I am of the considered opinion that the Trump candidacy is the equivalent, the contemporary equivalent of that open letter to Stalin from 1949. And I have also noted that in the early 50s, that 1949 letter and the Soviet note of March 10th of 1952, which basically agreed to the reinstitution of Nazi elements in Germany and the rearming of Germany as a third power bloc in the world. That Soviet note of 1952 was seen by the pro-Adenauer forces in Germany as opening up a bidding war between the West and the former Soviet Union. I would note that many institutions, such as the German-American Council, the Atlantic Council, and the Republican Ethnic Heritage Outreach Group, the Nazi wing of the Republican Party, inextricably linked both with CIA and the Galen Organization and the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, either began in just that period or greatly accelerated their influence in that time period. The bidding war was very successful. It ultimately gave Germany much more leverage over the U.S. and the West than it would otherwise have had, and a much greater degree of autonomy so that the underground Reich could continue to run things. What we're going to do is to open up the discussion by taking a look at America First. That was an organization in the pre-World War II period that was ostensibly isolationist. It looked to keep the U.S. out of the looming or eventually ongoing European war, World War II. It also aimed at promoting a nativist philosophy here in the U.S. Donald Trump has adopted America First as a slogan and as a political rallying cry, and I think that both the isolationist aspect of America First and the nativist aspect of America First are manifest in Donald Trump's use of that. And again, I think that the Trump candidacy at an international level is the equivalent of the open letter to Stalin published in the Bucher Zeitung of 1949. I've noted in that context that Joseph E. Schmitz, the former Inspector General of the Pentagon and part of the German-American and ultra-right-wing Schmitz family, was obsessed, as one Pentagon official put it, with, quote, all things German and all things Steuben, unquote, and had allegiances of one kind or another with several generations of members of the von Steuben family. And it was the Steuben Society that used the Bucher Zeitung as an outlet for their political views and propositions. I strongly suspect that Joseph E. Schmitz, whom we're going to come to in this program as well, is a dominant element in the shaping of Donald Trump's international political outlook.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
On the subject of America First, from The Guardian of July 25th of 2016, Trump has also, this, by the way, a story by Alan Yuhas, Y-U-H-A-S, again from The Guardian, is called Donald Trump and Allies Forced to Answer Questions About Anti-Semitism. It reads in part, skipping down, Trump has also adopted the rallying cry, America First, which became famous as a slogan of the famous aviator Charles Lindbergh and his fellow isolationists in the 1930s and early 1940s. See if something here rings familiar or resonant with Donald Trump's rhetoric. Continuing with this Guardian article, Lindbergh, who was welcomed in Nazi Germany several times before the Second World War, wrote about racial strength, unquote, and said civilization depended, quote, on a Western wall of race and arms, which can hold back either a Genghis Khan or the infiltration of inferior blood, unquote. Sounds rather like Donald Trump's wall across the Mexican border, unquote. More about America First. This from the Talking Points memo of April 30th of 2016 by Josh Marshall, putting America first, unquote. It is no accident that America First's actual historical progenitor is a 30s-era nativist, anti-Semitic, quasi-isolationism which was effectively allied with Nazi Germany. The real meaning of America First has always been that America is being taken advantage of, being exploited, and exposed, unquote. And still more about the history of America First. This from the book Undercover, My 4 Years in the Nazi Underworld in America by John Roy Carlson, published in 1943 and available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. Talking about how the German-American Bund, an American Nazi organization, basically adopted the America First sloganeering and ideology. The Bund had so antagonized most Americans by its swastika heiling phase that orders came from Berlin to cut out public singing of the Horst Wessel Lied, shell the Sam Brown belts and marching boots, and, quote, go American, unquote. The party line changed as a bucket of red, white, and blue paint was applied to make overnight patriots, unquote, of the Nazis. The Deutsche Weckruf, W-E-C-K-R-U-F, became the Free American, and no longer professing to convert the U.S. to Nazism, the Bund became nationalist and isolationist, showed great concern for the welfare of the Republic, and adopted the slogan, America First, unquote. And then, also from Undercover, John Roy Carlson notes how nationalist and promoting a different each country first is a common theme of the fascist movements of the 30s and 40s. Carlson writes, Mussolini's fascist system was first described as nationalist. The French fascist organization Croix de Feu, which developed into a Vichy instrument, was called nationalist, unquote. The Nazi Party is the National Socialist Party. The Japanese War Party is a nationalist, unquote, party. All these countries have their Germany First, France First, and Spain First parties. Recall that the motto of Sir Oswald Mosley's Black Shirts was Britain First, unquote, and Stauffenberg's slogan of the American National Socialist Party was America First, Last, and Always, unquote. America First can be no different in its connotation and ultimate outcome, despite the sincere intents of some of those who mouth it. America First is a cry unwittingly used by liberty's hangmen. And excerpting something we spoke about in, for the record, 697, the America First movement was actually funded by Nazi Germany. In this case, we're going to read from the book The Family by Jeff Charlotte, and we're going to talk about Baron von Ginant, who was the number two man officially in the U.S. Embassy in Washington, D.C. He was not only SS, he basically was the Gestapo chief in America. Again, from The Family by Jeff Charlotte. And we talked about this in For the Record 697. Only second secretary in the embassy, Ginanth, that's G-I-N-A-N-T-H, maintained a frightening grip over his fellow diplomats. He was an undercover SS man, the ears and eyes of the Reich's Ministry of Proper Enlightenment and Propaganda, charged with keeping watch over its secret American operations. He was, in short, the Gestapo chief in America, and one of those operations was laundering Nazi money and channeling it into donations to America First. Skipping down, von Ginanth devoted himself to changing Goebbels' gold into dollars, and those dollars into laundered, quote, donations, unquote, to the America First Committee, where unwitting isolationists, Abraham Varad allies such as Senator Arthur Vandenberg and America First President Robert M. Haynes among them, stumped for recognition of the fact, unquote, on Hitler's inevitability. I would note that Abraham Varad, the founder of what became known as the family, he was pro-fascist and a major Christian evangelist who helped to mobilize the Christian right as part of the Washington right-wing establishment. He also helped to with the post-war rehabilitation of Hermann Obst, who was the head of Deutsche Bank, the dominant financial institution behind Donald Trump. And so again, I think that both in its nativist manifestation and in its isolationist manifestation, the Trump campaign with its America First redux, so to speak, is not only hearkening back to the fascism and nativism of the original America First, but also to the isolationism of that movement, which basically benefited Nazi Germany and which paved the way for German hegemony in Europe and elsewhere. Before we return briefly to the subject of Joseph E. Schmitz, again, closely affiliated with, quote, all things German and all things Steuben. We suspect he is the advisor who helped to steer Trump in his pronouncements about Russia, Ukraine, and withdrawing from NATO, or at least looking upon NATO with a jaundiced eye, something that will resonate powerfully with Germany's ramping up of the progress of an all-EU army. We're going to return briefly to the landmark text, The Hitler Legacy, by Peter Lavenda. I did a 10-part series with Peter Lavenda about that book for the Record Programs 838 through 847. And he talks about the atavistic aspects of fascism and how both fascist movements of the 1930s, with which America First was affiliated, and in the contemporary period, basically looks to return to the past. We're reading now from the Hitler Legacy. Both the American Nazi and the Klan movements wanted America to go back to the way it was before the Great Depression, before the First World War, to a time that never really existed the way they thought it did. A time before the advent of communist states like the Soviet Union, a time before blacks and Jews could be considered equal citizens of the nation. Like many of today's extreme right protesters, the Nazis and Klansmen of the 1920s and 1930s wanted, quote, to take their country back, unquote. In this case, and possibly in the present case, also back meant back in time, unquote. Skipping down. This focus on purity could be seen as a desire to return to a more primitive time, in illo tempore, when the world was pristine. That this time probably never existed, did not occur, or was not acceptable to those promoting this return to nature and return to our roots philosophy. And I think that is more or less out front in the Donald Trump political agenda.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
I'm going to very briefly highlight some of the Trump political affiliations that I covered in For the Record 882. They are recapped in the description for the Record 920. First thing I ever read about Donald Trump came from a 1984 issue of Sports Illustrated magazine. It was about Donald Trump's ownership of the New Jersey Generals of the ill-fated United States Football League. This is by Robert Boyle from February 13th of 2015. And he notes several things about Donald Trump. First of all, his pastor was Dr. Norman Vincent Peale. His attorney is Roy Cohn. Norman Vincent Peale, as I recounted in yet another excerpt from Undercover, My 4 Years in the Nazi Underworld in America by John Roy Carlson, basically fronted for an Axis spy named James Roonley. Beyond that, he was very cozy with other domestic fascists such as Mrs. Elizabeth Dilling and the Reverend Edward Lodge Curran, the top aide to Father Coughlin. And Norman Vincent Peale was a speaker at a gathering of patriotic organizations at the Hotel Commodore in New York City. And that ultimately was bought out by Donald Trump. Roy Cohn, of course, was the top aide and counsel to Senator Joe McCarthy of red-baiting fame. I also noted that Joe McCarthy made liberal use of intelligence/dirt generated by John Frenchy Grombach, a U.S. intelligence officer affiliated with both CIA and the State Department, who relied on information developed for him by a network of SS officers headed up by General Karl Wolf, who was Heinrich Himmler's personal adjutant. And Joe McCarthy made liberal use of the information from John Grombach and from Karl Wolf's Nazi network. That from the book Blowback by Christopher Simpson. I will also note that as we looked at in AFA program number 2 from May of 1984, in turn drawing on information from the book The Nightmare Decade by Fred Cook, Joe McCarthy's backers, including and especially Walter Harnischjaeger, were Wisconsin-based German-Americans who had a very strong affiliation with Adolf Hitler and were part of the pre-World War II Nazi Fifth Column in the U.S., including and especially that element of that Nazi Fifth Column that was ensconced within the German-American population in this country, such as the Steuben Society. We also noted in an article from the Washington Post of March 5th of 1985, Helena von Damm's Viennese Waltz by William Brodziak, that Helena von Damm was very close to Donald Trump as well. Von Damm was a protege of Otto von Bolsing, an SS officer who was at one point Adolf Eichmann's superior in the SS and the administration of so-called Jewish matters for Hitler. And later, von Bolsing was brought to the U.S. Under the auspices of Alan Dulles and the CIA. Helena von Damm followed him and ultimately became the person who selected the lists from which White House personnel appointments were made. She eventually became U.S. ambassador to Austria. After that, she keeps her first husband's last name, von Damm. That is the name of Christian von Damm, whom last we saw was, he's a German-born banker who was head of Bank of America's La Paz, Bolivia branch in 1982, when that branch was undoubtedly helping to launder money from Klaus Barbie's Bridegrooms of Death, Coca Fascisti. So, again, one takes a look at present and past associations of Donald Trump. They hail back to the pre-World War II and World War II era Nazi and German Fifth Column in this country, and they evolve through the early Cold War period and on up into the contemporary period as well. As discussed in For the Record 918 and 919, one of Donald Trump's top advisors, particularly on foreign policy, is Joseph E. Schmitz of the ultra-right-wing Schmitz family in this country. His father was John G. Schmitz, a John Birch Society fellow, and someone who thought Richard Nixon was too liberal and so ran against Richard Nixon in 1972. I would also note that John P. Schmitz, the brother of Joseph E. Schmitz, was the former deputy counsel to George H.W. Bush when he was vice president, including during the Iran-Contra affair. He then became a Washington attorney who specializes in German and American trade policy and who has some of the most powerful German corporations as his clients. Something of a pivot point, noting that Joseph E. Schmitz is one of Donald Trump's top advisors. Of Joseph E. Schmitz, the McClatchy News Bureau of August 18th of 2016 has the following article by Marissa Taylor and William Douglas, D-O-U-G-L-A-S, Trump advisor accused of making anti-Semitic remarks about Joseph Schmitz. Allegations of anti-Semitism have surfaced against one of Donald Trump's foreign policy advisors, raising further questions about the guidance the Republican presidential nominee is receiving. Joseph Schmitz, named as one of five advisors by the Trump campaign in March, is accused of bragging when he was Defense Department Inspector General a decade ago that he pushed out Jewish employees, skipping down. Daniel Meyer, M-E-Y-E-R, a senior official within the intelligence community, described Schmitz's remarks in his complaint file. His summary of his 10 years achievement reported as, quote, I fired the Jews, unquote, wrote Meyer, a former official in the Pentagon Inspector General's office whose grievance was obtained by McClatchy. Meyer, who declined to comment about the matter, cited in his complaint another former top Pentagon official, John Crane, as a source and witness to the remarks. Crane worked with Schmitz, who served as Inspector General between April 2002 and September 2005. In his complaint, Meyer said Crane also said Schmitz played down the extent of the Holocaust. In his final days, he allegedly lectured Mr. Crane on the details of concentration camps and how the ovens were too small to kill 6 million Jews, wrote Meyer, whose complaint is before the Merit Systems Protection Board. And skipping down in the story. Though Schmitz left government in 2005, he has inserted himself in public affairs often through writing editorials and giving speeches. Schmitz spoke to law students in March of 2015 at Southern Methodist University in Dallas in a forum about communism and its impact on society. Renwei Renwei Chung, C-H-U-N-G, a student who took notes of Schmitz's speech, said it appeared to him that Schmitz was calling Obama a communist, unquote. He described how Schmitz held up the book The Communist, Frank Marshall Davis, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mentor, and said to the forum, quote, the Chinese worship Mao. They have pictures of Mao everywhere. Do you know who the second most popular person in China is? Obama. Why is that? Unquote. Jeffrey Kahn, a professor who spoke at the phone, said the encounter with Schmitz left him chilled, unquote. Kahn wrote in an opinion piece published in July in the Dallas Morning News that, quote, I had witnessed a ghost from McCarthy's staff, unquote, a reference to former Senator Joseph McCarthy, who was obsessed with exposing communists in the 1950s. What foreign policy advice will Schmitz whisper into Trump's ear, Kahn wrote. I shuddered to think what he might do in such a position of power. Well, I think that is worth contemplating. And again, I think the substance of what was reported in that story about Joseph Schmitz indicates that Schmitz, quote, obsession with all things German and all things Steuben, as one former Pentagon official put it, is not just Germanophile in and of itself, but comes from a deeper Nazi-style political orientation. And indeed, what is now being journalistically termed the alt-right is front and center in the Trump campaign, and there really can be no doubt about that. Alt-right is the latest term for basically American fascism and doctrinaire racism. I don't particularly like the use of the term. Suffice it to say, in our next program, where we take a look at the high-profile hacks of the DNC and the NSA, those are tracking back to what I have termed Team Snowden, WikiLeaks people associated with Edward Snowden, if not, in fact, Snowden himself. That whole team, WikiLeaks, Snowden, Glenn Greenwald et al., they are alt-right. Their pretenses to the contrary notwithstanding, and the reflexive adulation slash idolization and utter brainlessness of the so-called progressive sector, notwithstanding, they are alt-right. And the alt-right is front and center in the Trump campaign. When Paul Manafort stepped down as Trump's campaign, the top campaign official, after disclosures of his work on behalf of the Yanukovych government in Ukraine, in all probability paving the way for the Maidan coup, all of Manafort's links go to the far right, and indeed he was an advisor to Ferdinand Marcos in the 1980s, when Marcos was helping to dig up Golden Lily loot, and then was replaced in the People Power coup when he refused to share that loot sufficiently with the U.S. Now a guy named Steve Bannon, who was formerly in charge of the Breitbart Center, B-R-E-I-T-B-A-R-T, is heading the Trump campaign. From the Daily Beast of August 17th of 2016, a story by Betsy Woodruff, W-O-O-D-R-U-F-F, and Gideon Resnick, R-E-S-N-I-C-K, alt-right rejoices at Donald Trump's Steve Bannon hire. The intro, as Breitbart's chief, Steve Bannon did a lot to normalize the racist, anti-Semitic world of the alt-right. Now, they rejoice as he joins the campaign of their king. Donald Trump's campaign is under new management, and his white nationalist fanboys love it. The campaign's new chief executive, Stephen Bannon, joins from Breitbart News, where he helped to mainstream the ideas of white nationalists and resuscitate the reputations of anti-immigrant fear-mongers. White nationalists today invest a lot of energy worrying about growing Hispanic and Muslim populations in the U.S. It turns out that Breitbart News spends a lot of time worrying about those things as well. And in Steve Bannon, they see a media-friendly, ethno-nationalist fellow traveler. Naturally, Breitbart emerged as a nationalist site and has done great stuff on immigration in particular. VDare.com editor Peter Brimlow, or Brimlow, B-R-I-M-E-L-O-W, told the Daily Beast. VDare is a white supremacist site. It's named after Virginia Dare, the first white child born to British colonists in North America. Brunlow said he and Bannon met briefly last month and exchanged pleasantries about each other's work. Skipping down, Brunlow is not the only prominent white nationalist to praise the Bannon hire. Richard Spencer, who heads the white supremacist think tank National Policy Institute, said he was also pleased. Under Bannon's leadership, Breitbart has given favorable coverage to the white supremacist alt-right movement, and Spencer loves it. Quote, Breitbart has elective affinities with the alt-right, and the alt-right has clearly influenced Breitbart, he said. In this way, Breitbart has acted as a gateway to alt-right ideas and writers. I don't think it has done this deliberately. Again, it's a matter of elective affinities, unquote. Beginning again, Spencer said Breitbart and Bannon have helped alt-right ideas gain legitimacy and, more importantly, exponentially expand their audiences. He cited the work of Milo, M-I-L-O, Yiannopoulos, Y-A-N-N-O-P-O-U-L-O-S, as evidence of this. And skipping down again, Steve Bannon didn't just make Breitbart a safe space for white supremacists. He's also welcomed a scholar blacklisted from the mainstream conservative movement for arguing that there is a connection between race and IQ. Breitbart frequently highlights the work of Jason Richwine, R-I-C-H-W-I-N-E, resigned from the Conservative Heritage Foundation when news broke that his Harvard dissertation argued in part that Hispanics have lower IQs than non-Hispanic whites. Bannon loves Richwine. On January 6th of this year, when Richwine was a guest on the radio show, Bannon called him, quote, one of the smartest brains out there in demographics, demography, this whole issue of immigration, and what it means to this country, unquote. And again, that not only hearkens to the eugenics pseudo-discipline, which was at the core of Nazi racial policy, but also obviously resonates powerfully with Trump's nativist and anti-immigrant, anti-Latino stance in particular. I've noted, and again, this can be determined easily enough with an internet search, that Fred Trump, Donald Trump's father, was deeply involved with his son's career and helped to launch it. Fred Trump was cited several times by federal regulatory authorities for exercising anti-black discrimination in his housing projects, and in fact, the late folk singer Woody Guthrie actually had an encounter with Fred Trump. There are indications that Fred Trump may have been involved with the Ku Klux Klan, one of whose most prominent alumni, David Duke, is an above-board enthusiastic supporter of Donald Trump. There was a story in Vice News of March 9th of 2016, which is excerpted at length in the written description for this program. It's by Mike Pearl. All the evidence we could find about Fred Trump's alleged involvement with the KKK. Now, I'm going to summarize much of this. There was a Klan rally in 1927 in New York City. A number of people were arrested at this Klan rally, and one of those people was certainly Donald Trump's father, Fred Trump, who would have been a young man of 21 at the time. Excerpting from this story, asked if his father had lived at 175-24 Devonshire Road, the address listed for the Fred Trump arrested at the 1927 Klan rally, Donald dismissed the claim as, quote, totally false, unquote. We live on Wareham, W-A-R-E-H-A-M, he told Horowitz. The Devonshire, I know there is a road Devonshire, but I don't think my father ever lived on Devonshire. Trump went on to deny everything else in the New York Times account of the 1927 rally. Quote, "It shouldn't be written because it never happened, number one, and number two, there was nobody charged." Unquote. Well, actually, it did happen, and a number of people were charged. And one of those people was, there were a number of people arrested. One of the people arrested was Fred Trump, although he was later released without being prosecuted. Continuing with this account. Biographical records confirm that the Trump family did live on Wareham Place in Queens in the 1940s when Donald was a kid. But according to at least one archived newspaper clip, Fred Trump also lived at 175-24 Devonshire Road. A wedding announcement in the January 22, 1936 issue of the Long Island Daily Press places Fred Trump at that address and refers to his wife as, quote, Mary McLeod, capital M-A-C, capital L-E-O-D, which is Donald Trump's mother's maiden name. So certainly the Fred Trump arrested at that Klan rally was indeed Donald Trump's father. It's not clear if he was a bystander, although other newspaper accounts of that described berobed Klan marchers as the arrestees. Whether that included Donald Trump's father or not is not determined. But certainly it is interesting and very possibly altogether significant that Donald Trump's father, certainly apparently a racist like Trump himself, may very well have been a member of the Ku Klux Klan or affiliated with them in some way. I would note that in the period between the World Wars, the KKK was not only very popular, but also in the 1930s had strong links with organizations like the German-American Bund and other elements of the pro-Nazi Fifth Column in the United States.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
A picture that is worth a thousand words, or as I have punned in the past, perhaps a thousand-year Reich, was featured in a 2015 campaign ad by Donald Trump that was tweeted by him. The ad features a picture of Donald Trump against the background of the American flag, a picture of the White House, and a picture of what appear to be soldiers marching to battle. All very mainstream patriotic icons, except that when one looks closely at the soldiers, they are not American GIs at all. In fact, they are World War II reenactors who are wearing uniforms of the Waffen-SS. We're going to talk about that in a second. The photographer who took those is a guy named George Cairns, C-A-I-R-N-S. He is a British photographer, and his brother John Cairns, a photographer, also takes pictures of World War II reenactors. And in what coverage by Mother Jones magazine termed an almost an incredible coincidence, or impossibly bizarre coincidence, is their exact phrasing. One of John Cairns' photographs of Waffen-SS clad World War II reenactors was used in 2010 by a North Carolina state legislator, Republican, of course, named Tim Spear. A couple of articles about this from Mother Jones magazine of July 14th of 2015 by Ben Dreyfuss, D-R-E-Y-F-U-S-S. Donald Trump just tweeted a campaign ad featuring what look like Nazi soldiers. And it's talking about this picture, and the picture is in the description for the record, 920. And it is of Waffen-SS clad World War II reenactors. Donald Trump passed off this tweet as the work of an intern. That is standard Trump fare. I suspect that this was basically a dog whistle for what I had termed the Underground Reich. Yet another Mother Jones side story to that, also from July 14th of 2015, the insane story behind Donald Trump's deleted Nazi tweet, this by Tim McDonnell. And it talks about George Cairns. Cairns is a British freelance stock photographer and photography instructor who says he frequents war reenactments as good locations to pick up realistic-looking stock images, not just of Nazis, but also of American GIs and other soldiers. Skipping down. In an almost impossibly bizarre coincidence, this isn't the first time the Cairns family has been caught up in a photo kerfuffle involving Nazis and American politicians. George's brother John is also a stock photographer and took the image of Nazi reenactors that was, quote, accidentally, unquote, used in a flyer for the campaign of North Carolina State Legislator Tim Speer in 2010. I have photos of American soldiers as well, Cairns said, but for some reason politicians, and I would add American GOP politicians, seem to be downloading Nazis, unquote. Trump has made something of a cottage industry for his campaign of retweeting, quote, alt-right or Nazi tweets. Yahoo News of July 2nd of 2016, an article by Caitlin, C-A-I-T-L-I-N, Dixon, D-I-C-K-S-O-N. Trump sparks online firestorm with anti-Clinton tweet featuring Star of David. Presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump drew widespread rebuke on Saturday with a tweet featuring a Star of David while accusing rival Hillary Clinton of corruption. The star, a symbol of Judaism, was on the backdrop of $100 bills and paired with a Fox News poll in which a majority of respondents described Clinton as corrupt. Next to Clinton's face was a red Star of David bearing the words, "Most corrupt candidate ever." Trump eventually said that the star was a sheriff's badge, and again, it was blamed on subordinates. However, we find this from the Newsmic blog of July 3rd of 2016. This is by Anthony Smith. Donald Trump's Star of David Hillary Clinton meme was created by white supremacists. Donald Trump tweeted the meme Saturday that used dog whistle anti-Semitism to announce that his political rival, Crooked Hillary, had, quote, made history, unquote. The meme Trump tweeted prominently featured the Star of David, a holy symbol of the Jewish religion that Nazis attempted to pervert by forcing Jews over the age of six to sew it onto their clothing during Hitler's reign. Emblazoned onto the Star of David in Trump's meme are the words, "Most corrupt candidate ever," and the star lies atop a giant pile of money. Newsmax discovered Sunday that Donald Trump's Twitter account wasn't the first place the meme appeared. The image was previously featured on /PLL/, an internet message board for the alt-right, a digital movement of neo-Nazis, anti-Semites, and white supremacists, newly emboldened by the success of Trump's rhetoric. As early as June 22nd, over a week before Trump's team tweeted it, skipping down. Of note is the file name of the photo, capital Hill, H-I-L-L, capital H-I-S-T-O-R-Y dot J-P-G, potentially a nod to the neo-Nazi code for H-H or Heil Hitler, which the alt-right is fond of hiding in plain sight. And to no one's surprise, ex-KKK leader David Duke loved Trump's Star of David tweet by Catherine Kruger, Talking Points Memo Live Wire of July 5th of 2016. avid Donald Trump supporter and former Ku Klux Klan leader David Duke was a big fan of the presumptive GOP nominee's controversial tweet over the weekend, which was widely read as anti-Semitic. After the Trump camp pulled an anti-Hillary Clinton tweet that included a 6-point star and posted an edited version, Duke tweeted Saturday that he welcomes the exposure of, quote, the hidden hand, unquote. And bear in mind that David Duke is something of a trace element for politically locating not only WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, but Eddie the Friendly Spook Snowden as well. More about that next week. Now, one of the major principles in political analysis is following the money. In For the Record 919, we excerpted a New York Times investigation of some of Donald Trump's altogether opaque real estate investments, and we noted that prominent Borman Capital Network banks or associated banks like Deutsche Bank and the Union Bank of Switzerland were affiliated with some of those, and that other of the highly complex and opaque Donald Trump real estate investments appeared to be either fronts for and or money laundering vehicles for prominent German industrial families and aristocrats. The dominant financial institution that has backed Donald Trump and that has put up hundreds of millions of dollars in loans for his operations is none other than the Deutsche Bank, the number one bank affiliated with the Borman Capital Network. From the Wall Street Journal of May 20th of 2016, an article by Anupreta, A-N-U-P-R-E-E-T-A, DAS, D-A-S. When Donald Trump needs a loan, he chooses Deutsche Bank, skipping down. While many big banks have shunned him, Deutsche Bank AG has been a steadfast financial backer of the Republican presidential candidate's business interests. Since 1998, the bank has led or participated in loans of at least $2.5 billion to companies affiliated with Mr. Trump, according to a Wall Street Journal analysis of public records and people familiar with the matter. That does not include another loan of $1 billion that Deutsche Bank made to Trump-affiliated entities. The long-standing connection makes Frankfurt-based Deutsche Bank, which has a large U.S. operation and has been grappling with reputational problems and an almost 50% stock price decline, the financial institution with probably the strongest ties to the controversial New York businessman. By 2005, Deutsche Bank had emerged as one of Mr. Trump's leading bankers. Eventually, that relationship went south up to a point. Some members of the Deutsche Bank operation turned to basically shunning Trump. However, that was not the final analysis, skipping down. But not everyone within Deutsche Bank wanted to sever the relationship. The company's private banking arm, which caters to ultra-rich families and individuals, picked up the slack, lending well over $300 million to Trump entities in the following years. Implications of that noted by Mother Jones of June 1st of 2016, an article by Russ Choma, C-H-O-M-A, and David Korn. Trump has a conflict of interest problem no other White House candidate ever had, unquote. The presumptive GOP nominee also has a tremendous load of debt that includes five loans of over $50 million. The disclosure form which presidential candidates must submit does not compel candidates to reveal the specific amount of any loans that exceed $50 million. Two of those mega loans are held by Deutsche Bank, which is based in Germany but has U.S. subsidiaries. What are the implications of the chief executive of the U.S. government being in hock for $100 million or more to a foreign entity that has tried to evade laws aimed at curtailing risky financial shenanigans, that was recently caught manipulating markets around the world, and that has attempted to influence the U.S. government? Not only that, but some of Trump's loans to the Deutsche Bank basically were backed up by a George Soros consortium from the Trump Soros Chicago WordPress.com blog, that George Soros freed Donald Trump of a $312 million debt. This from March 19th of this year, 2016. Speaking of one of those loans, yet Trump did not have to worry about paying back the majority of his mezzanine loan. A special group of lenders came in and erased a significant portion of this loan. Skipping now. Basically, George Soros and the others forgave Trump as much as $312 million for no reason. And again, George Soros got his start in business, Aryanizing Jewish property in Hungary during the Holocaust, something that he feels no regrets over. We have speculated in the past that Soros is a Mormon Jew. So the dominant money behind Donald Trump, Deutsche Bank, and also in certain instances, Soros interests as well. At some point, an underground Reich must begin manifesting as an above-ground political movement. I think that is what we are seeing. This concludes For the Record program number 920, The Trump and Confabanda, Part 3, The Underground Reich Comes into Plain View. This is being recorded on September 1st of 2016. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.